This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Complete election, membership, and volunteer information is available at kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Pleasure to be with you. www.newcapitalshow.com is our website. I'm coming to you from the studios of KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. Coming up in a little bit on the show will be Sasha Abramski, whose book Breadline USA has just appeared, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. Sasha and I will be talking about what is the state of hunger in America, how deep is it, how broad is it, and the nature of it. And, of course, we'll touch on what causes hunger in America, issues related to poverty, wages, and so forth. So much going on economically in the world. Of course, the economy is really the key issue on everybody's mind. And we can never forget that the economy is so interrelated with everything. When we're talking about the economy, we're not just talking about money. We're talking about lives. We're talking about priorities. We're talking about politics. We're talking about justice. We're talking about how we are organized as communities and so forth. And so, I love doing this show because the subject of economics touches so many of these different things, energy, healthcare, and it's very gratifying to see, even though we are going through such difficult times, really on a worldwide basis, it's gratifying to see people turning their attention to this subject and educating themselves about the subject, learning about what are the mechanisms of economics, how does economics work, what is the proper way to think about economics. How do I contextualize it? And it's not extraordinarily complicated either. No one should think that economics is so complicated that they can't learn something about it. In that light, I would like to make mention of a resource that I think is terrific that has been emerging and is really emerging even more now that it's become a four-part series on PBS, which is originally a book called The Ascent of Money. The Ascent of Money. This is by Niall Ferguson. I'm sure you can get the book at any bookstore. It was a New York Times bestseller and is now a four-part series on PBS. The first part of it aired last night, and I think that you can watch it again online. If you go to the pbs.org website, you can catch how to pick up or just Google on Ascent of Money, a tremendous, tremendous documentary about how the issue of money and economics and capital and finance have been interwoven in all of the recent epochs of history. Not even recent, going much farther back. How economics and finance were involved in Columbus's voyage, in the growth of the spice trade between Europe and the East. so many fascinating things in the Ascent of Money. Niall Ferguson has done a terrific job on it, and I would simply be remiss if I didn't mention that if you are interested in this subject, this is absolutely not to be missed, the Ascent of Money. And again, if you want to take a look at it after the show, you can do that online. I think episode 2 will air next week, and so on throughout the month. Little bit of news, and then I'm going to talk about an email exchange that I had with a friend, and then we'll get to Sasha Abramski in a bit. This is just off the press on New York Times, July 9th. Cities lose out on road funds from federal stimulus. Two-thirds of the country lives in large metropolitan areas, home to the nation's worst traffic jams and some of its oldest roads and bridges. But cities and their surrounding regions are getting less than two-thirds of federal transportation stimulus money. According to an analysis by the New York Times, of 5,274 transportation projects approved so far, the most complete look yet at how states plan to spend their stimulus money, the 100 largest metropolitan areas are getting less than half the money from the biggest pot of transportation stimulus money. Okay, so the largest cities are getting less than half the money, even though two-thirds of the population of the country lives in large metropolitan areas. The article says that in many cases they have lost a tug of war with state lawmakers that urban advocates say could hurt the nation's economic engines. This is the way that transportation has gone in our country for decades and decades and decades. As I indicated on a show a few weeks back, the way transportation funds are allocated in this country is that they go through either a highway building bureaucracy or a transit bureaucracy. And you can imagine that the highway building bureaucracy generally tends to be rural-based or suburban-based, and the process by which those projects get approved is very generally easy. They just basically request the money, and they get 80% of it, and the state or locality has to put up 20% of it. Those are the approximate numbers. It's very easy to get that money. But to do a transit program, and we know that our transit infrastructure in our urban areas has been under decay for a long time, right? This has been the intentional policy of the government, to starve our cities of the funds they need, and to not allocate the funds proportionately. This has been the policy. And to do a transit program, my gosh, you have got to jump through hoop after hoop after hoop, study after study after study. You've got to prove that there's a need to put a transit system in a city. I mean, who ever heard of such a thing? You got to prove that there's a need for a bus system in Houston. You got to prove that there's a need for a rail system in Houston. Right? City officials in the city of Houston or city of New York or city of Los Angeles line up like everybody else lines up and says, we would like this subsidy. And let's face it, it is a subsidy. We need this money to build a transit system. And they say, prove it. Prove you need a transit system in the city. Right? I mean, go back to the 19th century. You didn't need to prove it. Subway systems went into New York and Chicago, San Francisco, all these cities. There was no proving it. Now they got to prove it. Of course, what happened? We know the car industry, boom, you know, the car came about, and the car industry became a powerful lobby, and highways and freeways, which are part of the highway system, grew, suburbs grew, and what we see in the current stimulus bill is that this is still in effect. It may have changed, it may be getting better, but it's still in effect, and states, which are ultimately having a say in how these projects work, are basically overruling perhaps federal intentions for where the money goes. Senior fellow Peter Puentes at Brookings Institution says, if we are trying to recover the nation's economy, we should be focusing where the economy is, which is in large areas. But states take a peanut butter approach, taking the dollars and spreading them around very thinly rather than taking the dollars and concentrating them where the most complex transportation problems are. Owen Goodfriend, assistant professor of urban planning at City University of New York, he says we have a long history of shortchanging cities and metro areas and allocating transportation money to places where few people live. He is the author of 20th Century Sprawl, Highways and the Reshaping of the American Landscape. Let me be clear. I am not against highways. I am not against rural areas. I am a rural landowner. I benefit from good roads that allow me to get to my rural land. But we need to have the right balance in our transit plans. And we need to have the right balance now. We can't afford to continue to make the mistakes that we've made for decades and decades. Our cities should not be starved for transit dollars. And I'm hoping that this study that's being done or has been done by the New York Times, and which is front and center on the newspaper today, will turn some heads and cause some changes. Hopefully things will improve. The news on the carbon tax front. And I do call it carbon tax. It's fine. It's a tax. It should be a tax. Frankly, it's not enough of a tax. Our best scientists are telling us that the costs associated with injecting carbon into our atmosphere are egregious. I don't see any reason that we shouldn't listen to our best scientists. I know that there are a lot of people out there who are trying hard to argue against our best scientists. But I see no reason why we devote large amounts of capital to training scientists only to ignore them. They are telling us that there is a cost associated with capital. And so the world is in the process right now of trying to decide how should that cost be paid, by whom, over what time period, in what form. And it is not an easy process. Developing nations rebuff the G8 on curbing pollutants. Peter Baker reporting from L'Aquila, Italy, where the G8 is meeting the world's major industrial nations and newly emerging powers, that would be China, India, and so forth, Brazil, failed to agree Wednesday on specific cuts in heat-trapping gases by 2050, undercutting an effort to build a global consensus to fight climate change, according to people following the talks. Of course, this is the debate between already so-called developed nations like the United States and places like China and India, who argue, you, the United States, have burnt huge amounts of carbon in order to get to the point you're at with the standard of living that you have. Why should we be precluded from doing the same? And so the developed world says, no, we all have to set caps where we're under the same caps, and there is a failure to agree on this. I predict that ultimately we will all agree on this, but it is not happening right now, certainly not in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, which is hitting different countries in different ways. China reported, I saw, I think, on Reuters this morning or on Bloomberg, China reported a 50% increase in automobile sales last month. 50%. An increase of 50% over last year. Over last year's same period. So China's stimulus, how is everyone spending their stimulus in China? They're buying cars. The Chinese are buying cars. And of course, this is what has been predicted, which is that in order for growth, so-called growth in the world, to occur again, it's going to take the Chinese and the Indian consumer, who has been saving. The Chinese save 40% thereabouts. The U.S. last year saved 1 or 2% or even nothing. It's going to take the Chinese consumers to begin to spend to restore so-called growth in the economy, because the U.S. consumer is no longer spending. And, in fact, the U.S. consumer is now saving. Statistics show that the savings rate in the United States has absolutely skyrocketed from 2% or so or less last year, a few years before, to 7%. And it may go higher. Truly, we have gone into a new phase of American economic history. with the savings rate rising that dramatically, over a 300% rise in the U.S. savings rate, U.S. consumers are saving. One more piece before we get to Sasha Abramski. This is an email exchange I had with a very good friend of mine. This very good friend of mine is a he kind of stepped out of the business, an investment banker, a very successful investment banker. He worked at Goldman Sachs for a long time and then changed firms a few years ago. And there is an article that has caused quite a stir in the financial community, the blogs and financial journalists, bankers, and so forth. The article is Matt Taibbi's article. Matt writes for Rolling Stone. It's called The Great American Bubble Machine, and it basically takes on Goldman Sachs head on. I'll just tell you how the article starts. It starts like this. He writes, "The first thing you need to know about Goldman Sachs is that it is everywhere. The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money." Now, I would not say that that is necessarily the most gentle or objective way to begin an article. And I could see how a lot of people could have qualms with an article beginning that way. But the article goes on essentially to acquit itself of that beginning and provide a very strong journalistic detail of the effect that Goldman Sachs, as really the most prominent and prestigious of global investment banks, the effect that it has had on bubbles in the past years and Goldman Sachs' influence in the government here in the United States. I'm sure that there are things that could be agreed with in the article and things that would be disagreed with in the article. I sent this to my friend who used to work at the place, and he wrote me back. He said there is a real story about what he, meaning Matt Taibbi, is attempting to cover, but he has many inaccuracies and exaggerations that he fails to note at the core. He made it about Goldman Sachs because that is sensationalism, but it should be about the industry. Very bad things happened. That's a strong statement from someone who worked in that industry. Very bad things happened. Goldman Sachs did many of them. But to make Goldman the center of the story is naive and missing the point. There is a lot of influence by Wall Street in Washington. Goldman Sachs has much Washington influence. But to make it about Goldman Sachs people, to make it about Goldman Sachs people currently or formerly in power is, again, naive and missing the point. People love a blame story. It is easy and journalistically attractive to blame a firm or a relatively small group of people. In this case, it is inaccurate. I think people are upset about what happened, but everyone, and I mean everyone, benefited. There are people in way too many houses with way too much square footage, with way too many flat screen TVs, with way too many cars in the garages, which generated way more jobs than our economy could sustainably provide, that were all financed by the credit bubble. Even forgetting that, you can be mad at the financial system, but if we overreact and don't fix it the right way, everyone, and again, I mean everyone, is going to suffer. I wrote back to my friend and I said the following. I said, "I agree with you on some, but not on all. I think what you say is exactly right, that it's not all Goldman Sachs, but shared by the system, the government, the banks, hell, the people themselves. Ultimately, it comes down to each individual. What was each of us doing in those years, and what were we saying or not saying, thinking or not thinking? Obviously, a lot of people were off, given the result that we've gotten. When you say everyone benefited, I cannot agree with that. Maybe you did, probably I did, but we have been educated and lucky enough to either not get screwed and not screw ourselves up, and not to trust the messages that come from entities professing to be our friends, such as banks credit card companies, real estate brokers, car dealers, advertisers, politicians, etc. But the diversion of precious capital for poor projects, and I include in that most of the military misadventures during our lifetimes, the overconsumption of consumer goods, the overinvestment in housing, especially of the suburban variety, and the infrastructure to provide easy access to it, the enormous subsidies to particularly inefficient or polluting sectors of the economy has resulted, apparently now that all our governments are broke and banks undercapitalized, in the starvation of capital for superior projects, whether implemented by individuals, businesses, or government. So I actually think most people were probably hurt, not helped. And that is slowly, sometimes rapidly, dawning on them. They are saying, I thought I was doing so well, and look where I've ended up. No job, no savings, no health care, no education, no good public schools, no parks, no public transit, little healthy energy sources or food, but I've got a big house with TVs and a car. It doesn't seem like I made a very smart deal. A hedge fund manager at GLG in London published an Financial Times op-ed a few days ago that the dirty secret about recent Western capitalism was that mountains of consumer and mortgage debt were essentially used to buy off the middle class so that they would not look too closely while others were looting the national till in very dramatic ways. I don't know that it was an explicit conspiracy to do that, but I do think an attitude developed of, hey, everyone's benefiting with houses, cars, and TVs. I don't think it will look outrageous at all if I push for a $10 million bonus this year on top of my $2 million base salary plus a boatload of options. After all, we have free markets, and that's what I'm worth. And it worked for quite a while, as all of the national systems, regulatory, political, international, financial, etc., aligned to make the flow of debt for very specific purposes, houses, cars, and stuff, available to the masses, and the flow of debt for other purposes, chiefly the acquisition of massive cash-flowing corporate assets, available to the elite. It looks to me, though, like at least the elite got appreciating cash-flowing assets, while the masses got depreciating assets, when what they needed was more of what the elite has. Jobs, savings, health care, and education. So I think you're right that the article may be too focused on Goldman Sachs as a culprit, and it certainly, and unfortunately, is much broader than just Goldman Sachs. But I think it's successful, the article, in contributing to an exploration of the question of how did our systems of capital allocation that we so pride ourselves on get this result, and how did businesses whose very job is to ensure, in the aggregate, that capital is allocated for superior projects that contribute to a strong national community. After all, if banks don't do that, what is their point? How did we end up with their personnel making all the money, but the nation getting beggared? It's a harsh judgment, I know, not very nuanced and probably not very accurate, but it seems to me a reasonable portrayal of the big picture of what has gone wrong. That is my exchange with one of my oldest friends, who for a long time was on the inside of Goldman Sachs and other investment banks, and was an extremely hardworking person. I want to make that clear. This was an individual who was up before the crack of dawn every morning and on an airplane, flying somewhere to help a company raise money, worked very hard, and deserved to be paid well for what he did. They are not all enemies in the investment banks, but something went wrong to cause our system of allocating capital to get such poor results. And I agree, the blame, if you want to call it that, the responsibility, playing a blame game, probably is not the most productive thing we can be doing as a country, but it is informative for us to know how things happened, why they happened, so that we can put the proper fix in. The collusion between Wall Street and Washington, parochial interests, even at the local level, has caused us to make poor investments, and we need to make better investments. This is the New Capital Show. Coming up after a quick break, in fact, we're going to take a... Are we going to do the election promo? We've got to make an election promo. It's going to last a few minutes. This is part of what we do at a Democratic radio station. After that break, Sasha Abramski will be joining me to talk about his new book, Breadline USA. And we will talk about some people who didn't exactly come out ahead over the last few decades. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a few minutes.
It's still election season at KPFT. Over the last few weeks, we've been airing a lot of information about the elections because we want you to understand all the important aspects of the process. But right now, with a short time left in the nomination period, it's not a cliche, it's a very important truth. KPFT needs you. The whole Pacifica network, including KPFT, is at the most significant crossroads in its 60-year history. Nationally, music and culture and news media outlets are dwindling and becoming increasingly homogenized and corporatized. KPFT and the other Pacifica stations are the only places left where you can hear the news and music and information that really makes a difference in your community. It's what folks here in Houston really care about. But that crossroads is not only about media opportunity. It's about how the younger generations have gone through a national election cycle that has made them optimistic and ready to change the world, much in the same way young people felt in the early decades of KPFT. Suddenly, the old hippies and the young hipsters are all working towards the same goals. The tough thing is that just when we have an opportunity to engage all of that energy and passion, all of the Pacifica stations are at huge financial risk. We always work on shoestring budgets, but right now, with the current economic crisis, those shoestrings are being stretched to the breaking point. So this is when you can make the biggest difference. It's when we need you the most. We need you to step up and run for the board. The KPFT local station board quite simply shapes the future of KPFT. Here's a lowdown on what the board does. The local board makes recommendations to Pacifica's national executive director regarding the management of their station. The local board sends four of its members to be a part of the national board. That means they have an impact on stations all across the country. The local board approves the station budget. They oversee how the money is spent, and they also make sure there's enough money to spend. And most importantly, they make sure that everything that we do here at KPFT is fulfilling the mission of Pacifica. That's not some theoretical description. It's hugely important, real-world work. We have 24 members on the board, and although that sounds like a lot, when you think about the diversity of our programming and the diversity of the Houston community, that's only 24 voices around that table. That's a lot of ground to cover. That's why we need you to run. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. The deadline to become a member of KPFT so you can vote for the board is also July 15th. All the information you need about elections is on kpft.org. That's kpft.org. In order to make it even easier, we've scheduled a couple of election parties so you can get the information you need, gather the nomination signatures you need to qualify, and you can get all of your questions answered in person. So go to kpft.org, read about the election process, download the nomination packet, and come on down to the station at 419 Lovett for one of the election shindigs. That's Saturday, July 11th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and Wednesday, July 15th from 2 until 5 p.m. That's the deadline for nominations. You may only vote with an official ballot that KPFT will mail to members who are current as of July 15th. If you're already a member, please make sure your mailing information is up to date. If you're not currently a member, but you would like to vote, you'll need to join by July 15th. For membership, please call 713-526-4000, extension 314, during regular office hours, or send an email with your name, address, and phone number to membership@kpft.org. In keeping with the bylaws of the Pacifica Foundation, the local station board is composed of listeners, volunteers, and staff, elected to bring diverse voices from our region into the dialogue between community and the station, and to assist with fundraising, community outreach, program support, and general organizational governance. The local station board, quite simply, shapes the future of KPFT. There are three ways to qualify to vote and run. Contribute at least $25 to one of the stations, complete 30 or more verified hours at a foundation radio station, or obtain a special waiver from the local station board. Complete voting, nomination, and deadline information is on our website at kpft.org. We're looking for board delegates who have fresh perspectives, creative energy, and a dedication to bring together all aspects of the community that's at the heart of KPFT's mission. We hope you'll join us. If you have any questions, please contact me. I'm Election Supervisor Ann Shaw, and I'm at 713-526-4000, extension 303. Or you can email me at election@kpft.org. That's election@kpft.org. Thank you for listening. This is KPFT Houston.
This is KPFT General Manager Dwayne Bradley, and this is not a fundraising plea. It's an alert from the Pacifica Radio Network to you, KPFT listeners. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the Pacifica Foundation, a beacon of listener-supported, non-commercial free media since 1949 and 1970 here in Houston. You can help keep KPFT Pacifica Radio alive and get your voice heard by running for your KPFT station board and voting for the listener candidates this fall. Nominations are now open for the 2009 KPFT Local Station Board election. As part of the board, you will help ensure that KPFT continues to represent the diverse voices of our community. Please visit KPFT and pacifica.org/elections for more information. And contact the KPFT election supervisor to receive a nomination package by writing an email to election@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 303. That's 526-4000, extension 303. July 15th is the deadline for nominations to the KPFT local station board. How can you keep Pacifica alive? With all its diverse truth and insanity, run for the KPFT local station board and bring in good governance. Push forward the Pacifica mission to promote peace and justice through communication between all races, nationalities, and cultures. You can become active in the elections by calling KPFT election supervisor Ann Shaw at 713-526-4000, extension 303, or send her an email at election@kpft.org. In order to participate, you just need to be a current member of the station. So please, become a new member or renew your membership before July 15th by making a minimum annual donation of $25 or performing 3 hours of volunteer work. Please visit pacifica.org/elections for more information. And contact the KPFT local election supervisor to receive a nomination packet by writing an email, election@kpft.org, or calling 713-526-4000, extension 303. Remember, July 15th is the deadline for nominations. This is your Radio for Peace, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT Houston.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. Yep, we have to pause sometimes for business, and we pause for business. Business is important. Sasha Abramsky joins us. He is a freelance journalist and senior fellow at Demos, a policy research and advocacy organization in New York City. His work has appeared in The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, The Village Voice, and Rolling Stone. He is the author, most recently, of American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. And other books include Hard Time Blues, Conned. He received an Open Society Crime and Communities Media Fellowship in 2000, and he holds a master's degree from the Columbia University School of Journalism. Sasha, welcome to the New Capital Show. Great to have you on. Your latest book, Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. Tell us just a bit about hunger in America, how serious a problem it is. It's probably something that a lot of people don't know much about, and yet you took a lot of time to research it. You went on your own type of simulation to try to learn what does it mean to be hungry in America. So give us a few insights about it.
Well, I was listening to what you were saying about your friend in the investment banking world and how he had this idea that during the boom times, everybody benefited.
Everybody benefited. I mean, that's his perspective. You know, everybody benefited.
What struck me was that 4 or 5 years ago, I was traveling around the country and I was talking to people, and this was when, in theory, the economy was booming. There was low unemployment, there was high profit levels, Wall Street was soaring, the housing market was soaring. But I go into these poorer communities and I talk to people and they tell me, well, we have jobs, but they're minimum wage or they're near minimum wage jobs or they're casualized service sector work. And we're working hard and we're not able to feed our families. And I'd say, well, you know, what do you mean? You're not able to go out very often. You're not able to feed them what you want to feed them. And they'd say, no, we're literally unable to feed our families. We come to the end of each pay cycle and 4 or 5 days before the next check comes in, we've run out of money and we've run out of food and we're juggling whether to pay utilities bills or whether to risk our electricity getting shut off but be able to buy a little bit of food, or whether to buy medicines for our sick children, or again, buy food. And I started hearing these stories, and I thought, you know, that's absolutely extraordinary that in the middle of this booming economy, there's this layer of poverty that's emerged at the bottom of the economy that's going largely unnoticed. So I started collecting these stories, and I encountered people like Neil Owen, who was a 51-year-old in Northern California. And he was on disability, so he was getting a few hundred dollars a month from the government. His wife was working full-time in a factory. And I met him on a food line, on a bread line. And I said, you know, why are you there? And it turned out that his story was that gas prices had gone up so high that his family was spending all of their discretionary income just buying gas for their car, and they had nothing left over for food. So this 51-year-old man was literally online at a charity to get food that he could no longer buy. I went to upstate New York and I interviewed a woman called Obrisha Edick. And she was working for Walmart, which is the largest company in the world. And she'd been working there 7 years. And after 7 years, this 55-year-old lady was still only getting $10 an hour. And when the economy began wobbling, her hours had been cut. And she showed me her pay stubs. And there were weeks in the middle of 2008 when she was bringing home, after tax, less than $200 a week. And I said to her, well, you know, how are you feeding yourself? And she said, well, some weeks I have less than $20 a week to spend on food. And that's less than a dollar a meal. So I said, well, you know, what are you buying? And it turned out that she was literally living on discounted canned soups. And every so often she'd get canned meat, canned Spam. And she'd drink a lot of tea to give her caffeine. And once a day as a luxury, she'd have a can of Pepsi, a 40-cent can of Pepsi from Walmart. And that was it. That was her meal, her life.
So let me see if I can... So the picture that you're drawing is that hunger, beginning from your own observations several years ago, had infiltrated into a sector of into a segment of the population, that is, people who are working and hard. They were going hungry. They began to go hungry on your own observations a few years ago.
Well, it wasn't just my observations. I was talking to people who were working full-time distributing emergency food at food pantries, food banks. And they said, look, we've always had a hungry population in America, despite our sort of narrative of abundance for everyone. There's always been some people outside that narrative, whether they're people who are homeless, whether they're mentally ill, whether they're living in particularly remote rural regions. And that's tragic for those individuals, but we understand why they're hungry. But now we're seeing something new. And what they told me was, in the last few years, during the Bush presidency, what they'd begun seeing was that in many cases, a majority of their clients were the working poor. And these were people who, in a sense, were in a modern-day poverty trap. They were deemed to be too affluent for government programs. So the government measures the official poverty line as about $10,000 a year for a single person, which is a tiny amount of money. So there are plenty of people who, by a more reasonable measure of poverty, live in deep, deep, deep financial straits, who are deemed to be beyond the poverty line, above the poverty line. So they don't qualify for food stamps. They don't qualify for Medicaid. They don't qualify for many other government programs. And those guys are the ones, in a sense, who are the most vulnerable to hunger, because if they lose a couple hours of work 1 week, or if they blow a tire on their car and they have to get a new tire, or if gas prices start spiking, just things that are absolutely outside their control, suddenly their discretionary income plummets. And these are the people who spend all of their discretionary income on food. They're not buying flat-screen TVs. They're not going on holidays to the Bahamas. If they have any spare money, it goes to provide a meal for themselves and their kids. And these are the guys who increasingly just couldn't make it in the Bush era economy. They were, their hours were being cut, the minimum wage was stagnating, benefits were plummeting, they either had no health insurance, or if they had health insurance, they were underinsured. There were so many things that were being stacked against them. And those are the stories that I thought I wanted to tell, because it seemed to me that there was just something fundamentally wrong with the economic model that was being created and that was being lauded as a success story in 2005, 2006.
So you
was leaving millions and millions of Americans out.
So you tell a story in Breadline USA, which is a series of vignettes along the lines that you've just told us, people with actual names who live in actual places, who have to go through actual processes to obtain food from food pantries and food banks or on severely constrained budgets. You also tell a policy story, which tells us something about the numbers and how many people this is affecting. Can you give us some idea about how many people this is affecting and how many people this came to affect in the recent years? And maybe also what our current circumstances, which really began to blow up even more in the fall of last year, what that's done to those numbers?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in answer to the second part first, the obvious answer is, as the economy has gotten worse for everybody, the people at the poorest part of the economy, in the bottom 20-30% of the economy, those are the ones who have been hit hardest. They're the ones who had least savings to fall back on. They're the ones who are most vulnerable to home foreclosure. They're the ones who had the highest credit card debt or were using payday loans or other informal credit. And they're the ones who are already having to access food stamps or food pantries. So the answer to that part is, as the general economy has collapsed, the poorest sector of the population has just been hammered. But in terms of the broader numbers, we now have 32 million Americans on food stamps. That means there's just over 1 in 10 Americans now is only avoiding hunger by government intervention. We have another 10 million or so who are poor enough to qualify for food stamps, but for various reasons haven't accessed it. So that takes us up to about 40 million. And then we have many tens of millions more who at one or another point, even if they're not accessing food stamps, they are accessing charity. They're standing in bread lines. They're standing at soup kitchens. They're getting a bag of food from their local church. If you add all those numbers together, we're looking at about 60 million Americans, about 1 in 5 Americans at this point, who cannot feed themselves on the market. So it's not that there's a shortage of food, but the food isn't reaching the poorest part of the population anymore. And that's a stunning realization, but it's also a dangerous situation, because there's nothing more likely to promote political instability than mass hunger.
Let me ask you this.
People are hungry, they're desperate.
Are there any, just to cover all the bases, are there any credible critics of your figures who say, oh no, Abramski's got it wrong, it's not 1 in 5, 1 in 10, he's exaggerating? Is there anything that has come out?
The food stamp numbers aren't my numbers, those are government numbers.
Uh-huh.
They're published every month, and they're at about 32 million. They've been marching northward almost every month for the last 18 months, and they're higher now than they've ever been. The number that there's about 1 in 3 Americans, that about 1 in 3 people who are poor enough to qualify for food stamps don't actually get them, those are state-generated numbers. In some states it's higher, in some states it's lower. In California, in some years, about half of the people who are poor enough for food stamps don't qualify. In Texas, Texas has done a better job of accessing food stamps for poor people, so it's a lower number. But the average is about 30% of those who are poor enough don't actually get them. And then the food pantry, food bank numbers, those are generated by groups like America's Second Harvest, by various coalitions of city mayors and so on. Those are not my numbers. There are critics out there among right-wing groups like the Heritage Foundation who say, well, the problem isn't that poor people don't have enough money. The problem is that poor people make bad choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I quote in my book this extraordinary example of a lack of empathy. It's a report by a Heritage Foundation fellow who says, basically, we're giving too much money to poor people, and the result is they're spending it all on food that's going to make them fat. And the answer is give them less money so they eat less. And I thought that's absolutely amazing, because I've talked to so many people who are impoverished and who are surviving literally by the skin of their teeth, and they're not eating badly because they want to eat badly. They're eating badly because in many cases that's all they can afford.
Yes.
They don't have access to fresh fruit and vegetables. There might not be a supermarket within easy distance of their house. And in some of the towns I went to, there were no supermarkets within 50 miles, and food workers called those places food deserts. So the only food people had, unless they were willing to drive an hour, was either the local gas station, which sold junk food, or fast food outlets, or the food pantry. And I thought to myself, you know, for someone from the Heritage Foundation to make a comment that it was all about poor people spending too much on bad food, it really showed an extreme lack of empathy. And, you know, you asked me where we are today. I have hopes that with the Obama administration, empathy is more in vogue, that after two or three decades in which we just didn't talk about the problems faced by poor people, that now we're at a moment where people in power actually care about those issues. Doesn't mean they're going to manage to tackle them overnight, but I do think we're in a moment where finally we have senior figures in the national administration willing to take on poverty head on.
I'm talking to Sasha Bronsky, author of Breadline USA, his new book about the hidden scandal of American hunger and how to fix it. Sasha, I'm assuming that with this contraction of the economy, that with the large amount of foreclosures that are occurring, the rise in joblessness, that what we are basically seeing is an increase in the number of types of stories that you have documented in Breadline USA, that we're seeing in with a half a million job losses a month running, we're seeing entire families who are basically joining the panorama of hopelessness that you portray in your book.
Well, I think what's happening is that there's more and more people who are literally vulnerable to hunger, and then there's an increasing number of people who aren't yet vulnerable to hunger, but they're worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to an interesting conference in California about a month or two ago, and there was a progressive economist speaking, and he said that, look, in the past we've had this notion that we look upwards economically. So if we're earning $50,000 or $60,000 a year, we spend as if we're earning $100,000. We have expectations that one day we're going to be earning that much. And we make our political choices based around the expectation that one day we're going to be wealthier than we are. And that's sort of historically been how our economy works. And it creates a sort of set of political values that helps skew the economy rightwards. So, for example, if you're looking for a reason why so many people supported tax cuts that only benefited the top 1% to 5% of the population, well, the answer is a psychological one, that a whole bunch of people who weren't in that income bracket hoped to one day be there. And when they were there, they wanted their lower taxes. And the economist said, well, you know, now what's happening is people are looking downwards. They might be in the middle classes still, but they're worried because they see their neighbors losing their jobs. They see foreclosures in their neighborhoods. They see cars being repossessed. They know people who've gone into bankruptcy because of medical bills. They worry that they're going to be furloughed, et cetera, et cetera. And they're looking downwards, and they're thinking, well, I'm in the middle classes now, but I might be impoverished tomorrow. I might be beggared by the economy tomorrow. And that sort of creates an expectation, a different expectation than we've had in the recent past. So people are spending less, they're saving more, they're changing their personal habits financially, and they're changing their political habits. They're willing to vote for candidates who are talking about poverty or talking about ways to fix the inequality that's grown up over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
And they're less tolerant of candidates who say, look, the answer is smaller government, the answer is lower taxes, the answer is deregulation, because that no longer speaks to their realities. And one of the things I try and do in my book, because obviously the book, I started it in the boom times, I started writing it after the research, after the economy had collapsed, and I finished writing it after the election when we had a new administration. One of the things that I chronicle in my book is the changing political values and economic values that accompany this broader economic transformation we've seen.
Yeah. You spent some time talking about the minimum wage and the role that it plays in providing a baseline amount of money that can help a family support itself, how that minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation, has not been indexed to inflation. What is your perspective on that, and can you help us understand the role that a lagging minimum wage has played for families?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, they look at the book's title and they think my entire book is just going to be about food. And it's going to be about, you know, how do we bulk up the food stamp system, or how do we grow food locally, or whatever it might be. And I think they're somewhat surprised when I talk about my book. And in actual fact, most of my policy fixes that I advocate have very little to do with food per se, and an awful lot to do with economic change. And the reason for that is actually, if you think about it, fairly straightforward, which is that America doesn't have a food crisis. America has an economic crisis. We're not like Ethiopia in the mid-1980s, where the crops had failed and there was mass famine, and the rains have failed, and so on and so forth. We're in a country with an extraordinarily productive food production system. We generate more food per acre than any other country on earth and any other country in history. The problem is we have an increasing inequality. So there's these many, many millions of people at the bottom of the economy who just can't buy into the private food markets. And so in my book, I talk about things like the minimum wage. And I say, look, if you really want to get serious, if we as a society want to get serious about tackling hunger, it's no good to just throw a few million dollars into bulking up a local food bank system. What you have to do is you have to think about why so many people can't afford to buy food. And one of the prime reasons is the minimum wage has been allowed to stagnate. And that was not a passive thing. It wasn't that people accidentally forgot to raise the minimum wage. It was a policy choice. The minimum wage was raised to $5.15 an hour in 1997, but it wasn't indexed to inflation. And then for the next 10 years, the Republicans in Congress stood in the way of any raises to the minimum wage. They knew they couldn't quite eradicate or abolish the minimum wage, but they knew they had enough muscle to prevent it being raised, and in doing so, they could have inflation stagnate it almost out of existence. So by the time the Democrats regained control of Congress and raised the minimum wage in 2007 by a little bit, in real terms, it was at the lowest value it had been in half a century.
Yeah.
And that to me is staggering, because there's many, many millions of Americans who earn only the minimum wage.
Now, what about the argument that business makes that, a minimum wage ultimately is basically an artificial constraint on numbers of employment? We would hire more people if there was no minimum wage or a lower minimum wage, and that the minimum wage actually goes a long way toward holding down employment.
There's a couple ways to answer that. The first is that empirically, there's actually no evidence of that. States like California, which have a higher than national average minimum wage, until very, very recently didn't see huge unemployment. And the unemployment they are now seeing has nothing to do with the minimum wage and everything to do with the broader economy. Mm-hmm. In cities like Santa Fe, which adopted a living wage, chambers of commerce sort of created all these doom and gloom scenarios. And in actual fact, Santa Fe's employment went up. And the reason for that was people at the lower end of the economy had more money, and they spent it. If you give a tax rebate to someone at the top end of the economy, they tend to save it or they tend to invest it somewhere. The money doesn't circulate very quickly. But if you put $50 a week more into a poor person's wallet, that money gets spent very, very quickly. It's used for food, for healthcare, for diapers, for the kids, whatever it might be. The money circulates and it has a magnifier effect. So empirically, you can make a very strong argument that raising the minimum wage actually boosts the economy. It's a very effective stimulus. But then there's a moral argument, and that's an argument that was used by Franklin Roosevelt when he first created the minimum wage 70 years ago, more than 70 years ago. And Roosevelt said to companies that challenged him, he said, look, if you can't pay your workers a decent wage that will give them a modicum of economic security, it won't allow them to live in the lap of luxury, but it will allow them to pay their rent or their mortgage. It will allow them to put food on the table for their families. It will allow them to buy medicines when they need it. If you can't do that to your workers, then you shouldn't be operating as a company. And I think that's true, that companies which are profit-driven institutions have some sort of moral obligation to the workers who create the product that allows them to make a profit. And unless you enforce that, unless you say, look, you have to provide that modicum of dignity to your workers, then essentially it's not terribly different from enforced labor.
Yeah, it's always,
I think that moral component is a very powerful argument when it comes to the minimum
wage. It's always seemed to me that business will hire the number of people that business needs to get jobs, to get business fulfilled, and that if the minimum wage is raised, and basically it's going to come out of shareholders, it's going to come out of profits, it's going to come out of executive pay and so forth, but that it's not significantly going to impair the number of people. So I tend to agree with you on that. Sasha Bromsky, tell us all about the experiment that you did in which you put yourself through privation so that you could further empathize and understand what it's like physically to go through hunger.
Yeah, I was interviewing a lot of people, and I was traveling around talking to people, and I sort of had a really good sense intellectually of what my story was. But I also knew there were holes in the story. So I could talk to someone like Aubrecia Edick, the Walmart worker, and she could tell me, look, I'm living on $20 a week, and I could sort of intellectually construct a picture of what that looked like. But I wasn't following her home at night. I didn't know what she felt like at midnight when she was hungry but had no money for food. So at a certain point when I was doing the research, I thought there's something missing here. I've got to actually put myself into someone else's shoes while I report this. And I didn't want to be the poorest of the poor, because I think, you know, it's much easier to understand why someone who is either unemployed or they're earning literally the minimum wage, why they're struggling to put food on the table. But I think it's harder to understand as a reader, or as a writer for that matter, why someone who's earning $8 or $9 an hour is struggling to put food on the table. So I decided I'd put myself onto the equivalent budget of someone who was earning about $8 or $9 an hour. It turned out the median income for a McDonald's worker was $8.23. So I constructed a budget around the premise that I was a McDonald's worker earning $8.23 and working 40 hours a week. And I talked to so many people in those income brackets at that point that I knew roughly what people in that income bracket were spending on rent, were spending on car payments, on co-pays for their health insurance or medical bills, and so on. And so I constructed as detailed and as accurate a weekly budget as I possibly could based around that income level. And then I said, all right, what do I have left over for food? And in week one, turned out I had about $50 for food, which is about the same as the maximum value of food stamps. And it's hard to live on that, but you just about can. And I also said, well, you know, like most people in that income bracket, if I can, I'm going to use credit as a crutch. So for the first few weeks of my experiment, I let my credit cards go to help me out if I ran out of cash. And each week I changed the conditions a bit. So for 8 weeks, I would have this sort of basic premise of $8.23 an hour. But 1 week I'd say, all right, I go into work and my employer says, sorry, this week you've only got 30 hours of work instead of 40 hours. And I'd have to reconstruct my budget based on that. 1 week I'd say, well, gas prices have gone up $1 a gallon compared to the recent past, which is what happened in 2008. What does that do to my budget? And 1 week I'd say, well, I've burnt through all of my credit options. I'm now going to be cash only. What does that do to my budget? And as I tightened my conditions, I was basically mirroring what was happening in the broader economy in 2007, 2008, 2009. What I found was it got harder and harder and harder, and that from being in a situation where I could just about make ends meet, very, very quickly, this hypothetical McDonald's worker found himself in a situation where I couldn't. So I was skimping on meals. I was cutting out coupons to try and get on-sale foods. I was making these choices where if I run out of milk midweek, can I afford to get new milk so that I can have some milk with my cereal in the morning, or do I have to just give up on milk? Can I afford protein? If I buy a little bit of meat, what's that going to do to my ability to buy fruit and vegetables? And I start making these sort of, you know, almost inane series of calculations, which in my real life I never have to think about.
Yep.
And my portions would get smaller and smaller. My energy levels got lower and lower. I started cramming bad food into me as quickly as I could just because it was cheap and filling. So I started eating a lot of salty food.
And it just wore you down.
Wore me down. And, you know, I'm a healthy 30-something-year-old. I, you know, live a very comfortable life. I have a lot of things going for me health-wise, and yet very, very quickly, that diet made me lethargic. It made me depressed. I had a nutritionist at UC Davis I was bouncing the diets off of as I did it, and she'd say to me, well, you know, it's going to be fine for you because you're just doing this for a few weeks, but if you were doing this long-term, you'd be damaging your kidney in this way.
Sasha,
we're
out of time. It's been great having you. Sasha Bromsky is the author of Breadline USA. You have a new book coming out.
I do. It's called Inside Obama's Brain. It's on President Obama. It comes out in December.
Inside Obama's Brain. That'll be out in December. How can people find you if they want to find you?
The website for the book is breadlineusa.com.
Okay, and we'll make a link to it also on newcapitalshow.com. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
New Capital Show has been produced today by Laura Slavin, internet work by Stephen Reitman. We'll be back 1 week hence. Until then, I hope you have a great week and take care.
People listening to these airwaves. I'm Mo here with Dwayne to encourage you to participate in the local station board elections as a candidate, voter, or by helping with community outreach efforts.
The programming you normally hear right now is not going away. KPFT's election is really important, and we're breaking away from regular programming to tell you a little about elections.
Why should the listeners care about elections?
This is an election for KPFT's local station board. KPFT is part of Pacifica Radio, America's oldest independent media network, which is also the last radio network with a democratically elected board. Without your participation, KPFT may cease to exist.
We are really at a crossroads right now, in a good way and in a challenging way.
Nationally, music and culture and news media outlets are dwindling and becoming increasingly homogenized and corporatized. Sure, the internet has opened up a lot of outlets, but it's almost too much. It's hard to filter and takes a lot of time to seek that out.
Frankly, you can't beat the power of radio to show up in your car, in your cubicle, in your home, and surprise you and illuminate your thinking.
You're listening to KPFT right now because you know that.
But the crossroads are not only about media opportunity. It's the fact that just as the younger generations have gone through a national election cycle that has made them optimistic and ready to change the world, much in the same way young people felt in the 60s and the early 70s when KPFT started, just when KPFT has an opportunity to engage all of the energy and passion, all of the Pacifica stations are at a huge financial risk when our already shoestring budgets are being spread even thinner with the current economic crisis.
So KPFT is looking for board delegates who have fresh perspectives, creative energy, and a dedication to bringing together all aspects of the community that's at the heart of the Pacifica and KPFT mission.
We really need your help by making sure you are a member and voting.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.